tag on each one of the five boxes and read each one of the tags. With one position of the reader in front of the first box, we read the whole string of boxes. The reason why this is important is picture a whole bunch of boxes that are stacked on top of a pallet that's about to be moved by a forklift, and they've all got RFID tags, and some of those tags are buried into the boxes in the middle of the pile. Can you read them? And the answer is yes. When you build one of these networks just right, there's a little bit more smarts you can add to it. So tight coupling between antennas when they are a fraction of a wavelength apart. I have seen coupling as tight as 3 dB. He got coupling as tight as 7 dB. In the case of an 80-meter antenna, which is 130 feet long, and you got another one that's only 30 feet away, you got a very small fraction of a wavelength of spacing between the two. You got ground reflection. You got all kinds of things going on here. So that tight a coupling, although it's a lot more than he thought he desired, in my opinion, it's a blessing in disguise. So we'll come back to that one, Steve. I guarantee you got very close to 50 ohms across that, friction 25 ohms, with the two of them in parallel, across that hold-on frequency range. You could, if you want to, make the piece of transmission line between the transmitter and the T-connector, in my example, you could make that chunk of transmission line an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, make it out of 35-ohm coax, and now you've matched. The magic of 37, I think it is, 37 and a half-ohm coax, is that a quarter wavelength of it, or an odd number of quarter wavelengths of it, will match 25 ohms to 50. It's called the geometric mean. If I take the starting impedance, 50 ohms for my transmitter, the end impedance, the pair of 50 ohms in parallel, meaning 25 ohms. So I've got impedance number 2, 25. Impedance number 1, 50. Multiply the two together and take the square root. That's called the geometric mean. Use an odd number of quarter wavelengths of coax at the geometric mean impedance, and you will get a perfect impedance match. It's called a quarter wave matching transformer. In the case of VHF frequencies, it's very easy to do because you visit your local hobby shop, you buy a piece of K&S brass tubing of the right diameter, stick it down another piece of brass tubing of the right diameter. When you've got the right ratios of the diameters, you have 37 and a half ohm impedance, if that's the right number. I'm going to be plugging that into my calculator while I'm talking to you about this. And anyhow, the geometric mean, let me actually do it. 50, 25, multiply square root. Sure enough, 35.35 ohms. So if I made a piece of coax cable, a quarter wave long, 35.35 ohms, that's one of a number of solutions that will give you a perfect impedance match in the frequency region where there are where that thing I just created is a quarter wavelength or an odd number of quarter wavelengths long. Now if I substitute a pair of 50-ohm antennas instead of the 50-ohm terminations, in theory, I get the exact same results, but there's a catch. The catch is, if I take a pair of slightly different antennas and I connect them with a T-connector so that they are in parallel, and I sweep to some other frequency, in general, those antennas do not remain 50 ohms resistive. Every realistic antenna you and I are likely to use, Steve, when you go out of the frequency range of design, it's going to start developing some standing wave ratio. If you plotted that standing wave ratio versus frequency, you get a bathtub-shaped curve or a V-shaped curve. That's just plotting the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. If you go one step further and make enough measurements with a network analyzer or the right kind of an antenna tuner or whatever, you'll find out that off resonance when you go high, in general, it is inductive. When you go low, it's capacitive. Most antennas do this, not all. So in reality, your two antennas are shifting in impedance reactively as well as resistively. And yes, you've got them in parallel. And yes, it is calculatable, but it's not quite as simple as you'd like it to be. But if the antennas were ideal antennas and 50 ohms resistive at all the frequencies of interest, then the antennas would behave identically to the pair of dummy loads on the T-connector. So this really, what you're doing here, Steve, is you're giving a beautiful homework assignment to the list of instructions that Mel has been given us on the Smith chart. Once you know the impedance of the two things you're putting in parallel, there's ways you can enter that into a Smith chart. You can use whatever feed line you're using, 50 ohm, 70 ohm, 35 ohm, and how many wavelengths of it. Mel will teach you how to go clockwise or counterclockwise on the Smith chart from that point of plotting, find out what you're going to see on the new frequency in the shack or on that frequency in the shack, and then what's required with stubs and whatever to do tuning. So you're getting into that area, and you can have a lot of fun with it. And putting two dummy loads in parallel is without a doubt the first step. I personally have done that in order to measure the integrity of a network analyzer. I had a network analyzer. It hadn't been calibrated for a while. I put a dummy load on it, and it said, yeah, it's pretty good. I decided to go one step further. I put a pair of dummy loads in parallel with the T-connector on the front panel, and I said, okay, network analyzer, what do you think that is? And it said something very close to 25 ohms, and I said, you're a good network analyzer. KC2MDP, KQIW, the TechNet.
Very good, Dick, very good. Yes, the reason I asked this question is I acquired a couple of these dish antennas. They're Wi-Fi dishes. I think they're 2.8 Wi-Fi antennas, you know. And basically, I figured maybe if I could just, you know, parallel the two together, I could use them for 1.2 or even get them close. But what you're saying is basically antennas react totally different than a 50 ohm plain resistive load on the transmitter. Back to you.
Okay, if I understand what you just said, the Wi-Fi antennas are tuned to 2.4 gigs, 802.11.p, we'll say, 2.4 gigs. And if I put a pair of them in parallel, instead of operating at 2.4 gigs, are they going to operate at 1.2 gigs? No way. Each individual antenna, when you tune very far out of its frequency region, is going to give you some kind of highly reactive response in general. In general, a very high standing wave ratio. In general, it would be very difficult to transmit into it. I'll admit that with modern day gas FETs, you may be able to do a pretty good receiving job. The magic about receiving in most situations is that if you've got a high enough impedance gas FET, you can have a terrible mismatch and still get good reception. The best proof of that is you take a random length of clip lead, connect it to the semiconductor of your 80-meter receiver, and although the S-meter doesn't move very far, you'll do some darn good reception. The signal-to-noise ratio will be quite good. You'll hear all the strong signals that are on the band. So you try to do that at 2.4 gigs, and you're putting a parallel up and down in parallel, and you want it to work at 1.2. That ain't going to work in general. Give it a try. It's not going to explode. Nothing bad's going to happen. Try it. Whenever you've got two antennas, though, with a certain separation between them, you now have an interferometer, a phased array. You can now start moving their positions in space because they're making a more complicated antenna pattern. And you could use that antenna pattern to advantage. But just putting antennas in parallel and hope they work at half the frequency, in general, I think that will not work. I may have misunderstood you. Back to you, Steve. KC2MDP, KQLIW.
No, you got it exactly, Dick. Yeah, I acquired a pair of these things, you know, and basically I have no use for them. And I figure, well, you know what? Yeah, I got two of them. Maybe I can, you know, some magic in the back of my head. I figure, well, maybe if I stick two of them together, right? I remember that 25 ohm thing with the dummy loads. I figure, well, maybe it's worth asking, if I could use them for 1.2. I figure maybe it would work out. Well, what can you do? You know, I have to find some other use for them. Back to you.
Give it a try. It can't hurt. And if you've got the ability to measure standing wave ratio, you'll find out what's going on. In general, a Wi-Fi antenna is a low-power device intended for 1 watt. Your particular 1296 transmitter probably can put out quite a few watts. So to take an antenna that's 2-to-1 rung in frequency, made for low power, and put a lot of power into it, there's a slim chance you're going to get some smoke and flames. may make something hot. It may have a very high VIS-1. Be careful. Your transmitter may not be happy unless it's got a circulator on it to control the reflection. So it's something to experiment with. Building with coat hangers and other things you got around the house, antennas like Yagis and whatever, ground planes and so on, for $12.96 is a very easy thing to do. You've got lots of materials in your house that will make you, that allow you to build $12.96 Yagis. And I've written an article that you can get a hold of by going to Tom Williams' website, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. You go to his website, you just Google WA1MBA and you'll find it real fast. At the bottom of his website is an article by K2RIW on how to make a perfect, and I mean perfect, perfect impedance match on the dipole of the driven element of any Yagi you are about to build. It's a little bit of trickery that hasn't been published before. I don't know about it. I discovered it by looking at the charts in the Antenna Engineering Handbook. There is a technique by diddling the length and putting a variable capacitor across the two feed points of the driven element, and you can always make a perfect impedance match. I'm amazed that I haven't read that before, and we've all had that problem of, yeah, it's a nice Yagi, I like the pattern, but the darn thing's got a 1.9 standing wave ratio. And so you start experimenting with folded dipole, T-match, gamma match. You go through all kinds of things with the driven element to make a good, a better VIS-1. No matter what the driven element is, you don't have to change the design. Just do a little bit of diddling with it, and you can make it perfect. And that's what that article will tell you. Okay, I'm pretty sure now on my list that we're going to get to Paul in a minute. Bob, KC2MWA, I think he said he's just signing in. And so, Elias, you're number one on the runway. KC2QBX, I know you, by way of Richie into WJL, you're trying to get a hold of me, and you left a message on my phone this week. I was away in Florida. Sorry I didn't get back to you. But we're now going to take some nice time and discuss your particular set of questions. KC2, Quebec Bravo X-ray, I think it is. K2RIW. You got Elias. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. This is KC2QBX, and I have about 6 questions. The first, I'm actually doing a science fair experiment that has to do with if you take a microwave or you take other smaller frequencies, which will heat more efficiently. If you have the answer, I really don't want it now since that would ruin my experiment. But my first question is, what are the frequencies of nanowaves, pico waves, spectral waves, and atta waves? Because it wouldn't come up on my calculator. It came up as, one nanowave came up as 3 to the 16th, one is 3 to the 17th. I didn't know how to calculate it.
Okay. Lucky for you, I had a quick conversation with Andy, WA2CDL, today, and I heard a little bit more about what you're trying to do. So I've got some of the hidden information. I am guessing, and I could be wrong, I am guessing that part of what you're asking is, when RF energy coming off a transmitter plus antenna strikes objects, and one of the most entering objects I would like it to strike, just to know what's going on, is biological material. When a radio wave comes out and hits your dog, hits your body, what happens? And I can tell you for this, I can tell you for a fact that the American National Standards Institute has written a document called the C95 document, which tries to define radio frequency biohazard. In other words, how much strength of RF signal are you allowed to bathe a human being with, whether it be the general public, whether it be you, the scientist, run the experiment. There's slightly different answers, but how much RF energy can you put into a human being before he starts suffering deleterious effects? The 50-year history of that American National Standards Institute, with all of their measurements, has found that when radio energy hits biological material, the non-thermal effects. In other words, will it create hearing in your ears? Will it create nerve effects? Will it make your hand move and so on? For years and years and years, they've looked for non-thermal effects and essentially never found them. A couple of laboratories, a couple of institutions, a couple of research organizations thought they saw an extremely minor non-thermal effect. And when another laboratory does the experiment, the non-thermal effect is not there. It probably is measurement error. So I'm saying with 99% confidence, when radio energy hits you or any other biological thing, it only creates heating. Now, how much radio energy is allowed to hit you before the amount of heating creates some kind of deleterious effect? That's what that document tries to define. When you do study the C95 document, you'll see a beautiful curve in there where for various frequency regions, they tell you how much radio energy you're allowed to put into a human being without violating federal laws. And that's called the maximum permitted exposure, MPE, maximum permitted exposure curve. And what you will see is that it is a bathtub-shaped curve. The bottom line is that at lower frequencies, like, I'll pick a number, 1 megacycle, the majority of the RF energy flows right through you and does not get absorbed, and almost nothing happens. As you go to the VHF frequencies, between 30 and 300 megacycles, the majority of the RF energy is absorbed and turned into heat. When you go to the microwave frequencies above 1.5 gigahertz, the majority of the energy bounces off your skin. 20% is absorbed, 80% is reflected. And I'm giving you 3 points on the curve. In reality, it's a sliding curve as you shift frequency. Now, the heating of your food in a microwave oven is really the exact same effect. The microwave oven takes a 700-watt transmitter, bounces that signal back and forth inside the microwave oven and those metal walls, and the signal bounces as many times as it has to until your food absorbs the energy and your food gets hot. It absorbs the energy and it has the thermal effect, has the desired effect. So when you figure out, when you go one step further and find out what is creating the absorption, you'll find that it's the water in your food that does 90% of the absorption. You put a very dry piece of bread in a microwave oven with a glass of water, and you should always put a glass of water in a microwave oven when you're doing an experiment. It needs some kind of a load. You do that, and you'll find a very dry piece of bread stays ice cold, and the glass of water gets hot. So, very dry bread, although it's got a reasonable amount of mass to it, doesn't absorb. Water does. You add some water to the dry bread, and it'll run very hot in the microwave oven. So the major thing in your food that does the absorption is water. Turns out that a human being is about 90% water. So when the RF energy hits a human being, the majority of the RF energy that hits the water that's absorbed is being absorbed because of the water in your body. To do the experiment then, you could start off first by having a cup of water, and you create transmitters of various frequencies and known power levels, and you have a thermometer in the water, and so by turning on the transmitter for a given length of time and a known power of transmitter, you find out how much the thermometer in the cup of water goes up. That's one way you could do the experiment. That really is called a calorimetry experiment. The hard part for you would be to find transmitters of high enough power on enough individual frequencies. That's going to take a bit of a search on eBay, some buying, some bartering at flea markets, getting equipment, some help of friends, and whatever. It'd be nice to do the experiment with a 10 gigahertz mixer, 1 gigahertz 1296 ham radio transmitter, with 144 megacycle transmitter, like the one you've got right now in your hand, with a 30 megacycle meter sensor, and so on, creating the antennas for each of these bands that couple all the energy into the cup of water, or if you want to go one step closer to reality, it could be a hamburger or it could be a chunk of steak that has a thermometer in it. There's various ways you can do the experiment. I do recommend you do a little bit of research as to what has already been done. And so you're not going to be finding out the answer ahead of time, so to speak. You're doing research as to what's already been done. To some degree, you don't want to completely reinvent the wheel. I mean, we've invented the wheel already, as you probably know, Elias. But even though you do research and you find out somebody has done something similar, it's good to know that. It's good to know how he made the measurements, because you're going to come up with your own variation. Even if you do nothing but just confirm his curve that was done by the American National Standards Institute, if you confirm their curve with your methods of measurement, which will be very different than the way they did it. In the beginning, they tried to find out how much energy is absorbed, and they knew that the most vulnerable part of a human being is a eye. The eye doesn't have a big fluid flow. It's not very good at dumping the heat, and it can't take very much heat before you start getting a cataract to the cornea or a fogging of the lens. So what they literally did was to take a rabbit, clamp them down into a test fixture. I mean, if you're an animal lover, you're not going to like this. But they took the animal, clamped them down into a fixture, and put RF energy into his eye, and found out how much RF energy created eye damage. And that poor rabbit was not being treated very well, but that's what took place way back in the late 40s. So they were doing the equivalent of a temperature experiment on a piece of meat. Unfortunately, it was a living animal, but at least that made it one step closer to reality. So for the first 10 years of the radio frequency biohazard for the United States, way back in the early 50s, the measurements that we were allowed to use on a human being were based on what they found out on the red eye of that white rabbit. So I think you see, I'm giving you a bunch of suggestions of how you research this, how you perform the experiment. It's a very good experiment. It's not an easy one. It's not an easy one, Elias. This kind of an experiment, to really done well, is going to separate the men from the boys. Not easy, but still a darn good one. I may be a little bit off to one side, but I'm hoping some of what I've said has helped a little bit. And we've got quite a few other people on frequency. After I turn it back to you, I'm going to turn it over to them, and I'll bet you they've got some other suggestions as to how you can make this into a very good senior project science experiment. KC2, QBX, K2LIW in the SecNet.
Yes, comment.
Hi, I know how I'm going to do the experiment, sort of. I'm going to have the transceiver. I'm going to connect it to an amplifier, which is also something that I need to get. It's going to go to an antenna switch, and then I'm going to take it to a dummy load. I'm going to take the dummy load, and I'm going to put the food inside it. The only problem is the dummy load. I need to know if it just lets out heat or the RF radiation. And another thing is, how could I figure out the resistance of my microwave so that I can match it up with the dummy load? How can I find the power of the microwave? I just need to figure out how to match it up. Back to you.
Okay. I know that somebody wants to make a comment. We're going to get to you in a second. If you try to take the chunk of meat, I think it was, or whatever the substance is, and put it inside of a dummy load, I'm not recommending that approach. I won't say it can't be done. Of the RF energy that hits a dummy load, the dummy load itself is usually a power type 50 ohm resistor, which has got a heat sink built into it. And so, in general, there's no airspace in there. There's no place where you can put another substance. But even if you could, the 50-ohm connector is impedance matched to the internal 50-ohm resistor of the dummy load, and therefore 99% of the energy will flow into that resistor and not flow into your chunk of material that you're putting in there with it as part of your test. And of the your chunk of material will experience heating. But is it contact heating and convection heating because it's in the vicinity of the 50-ohm resistor, or is it RF energy hitting the substance itself? I think it's going to be 99% the first and not very much of the second. So that's a tough way to go. A better approach would be to create a compact antenna. There are various kinds of compact antennas where the antenna really emits a signal that goes into space. And at a very short distance in front of the antenna, you put the material that is your absorber, whether it be a hamburger or a piece of plastic or a piece of resistive material, a resistive card, for instance. There's various ways you can make a free space power absorber. So a free space measurement has a little bit more pizzazz as an experiment. You could, I think, do something like a diathermy experiment. In other words, you could create a small box that has two large plates, and the RF energy is applied across the two plates. The plates are set up like a capacitor, and ordinarily the capacitor would have an airspace between the two plates, but you put the material under test between the two plates. That's a diathermy experiment. That's the way a diathermy machine of 40 years ago used to operate. Those two plates would be put across your knee, they turn on the machine, your knee gets warm, and in theory it creates some healing effect to your knee, the internal heating created by a diathermy machine. So that's a slightly better way. And so in that case, you're building a capacitor that has a defined amount of E-field internally, and therefore how much of that E-field between the two plates is absorbed by your material. That in itself is a very nice experiment. It's a real experiment of what's called permittivity. In other words, you're measuring the capacitive loading, the resistive loading. See, every object you put between the plates of a capacitor has what's called capacitive effect and dummy load effect. It's really called loss tangent. Plexiglass, for instance, is a material that has a very low loss tangent, and water is a material with an extremely high loss tangent. You put water between the plates of a capacitor, and it does a beautiful job of absorbing your energy. You put a piece of plexiglass between the two plates of a capacitor, and although the plexiglass is changing the capacitance in microfarads, it is not absorbing the energy. Teflon and plexiglass are very low-loss materials. Water is a very high-loss material. A piece of hamburger is very close to water. It'll be a high-loss material. So the capacitive plate approach, I think, is a better way than putting it inside the material inside of a dummy load or putting it inside of an antenna. As you can tell, I'm talking out loud here and performing the experiment and making a suggestion. It's not the only way to do it. Somebody did say they had a suggestion. Let's find out who that is, and let's listen to that suggestion. Start off with the call letters and name, if you're not somebody who has already signed in. KQR, this is the WMA TechNet, and Dick and Elias are listening.
Yeah, this is Frank again. Let me see if I have it.
You got it, Frank.
Okay. I just wanted to tell you that some years ago, my grandson had a project that he actually came up with himself. He wanted to determine possibly the effect of radiation. He was at Regis. And so he asked me about it, knowing, of course, that I was a ham. We found out that the natural resonance frequency of the average human skull was approximately 400 megahertz. So we decided to do this at 432. I gave him EasyNeck. He designed, you know, from the computer program, a little 432 antenna. I gave him the aluminum. He built it, etc. And we went over to the school. I went over with 100 watts. A transceiver and 100 watt amp. Anyway, what he did, or what his idea was to use bacteria. And he had a number of petri dishes, and we radiated or subjected the bacteria to different time periods of RF from the little directional antenna that we had, and then he proceeded to. After that was done, you know, then they monitored the bacteria to see if the RF had affected it in any way.
that you scared me a little bit when you told me that the head resonates at 432. You had a 100-watt transmitter. And I was a little bit afraid you were going to put 100 watts into a human head. Thank goodness you didn't do that. And by the way, I do know a man who did that. He went to Mount Equinox with a reasonably high-power 432 megacycle transmitter, connected it to a corner reflector, put it on a broomstick handle, taped that to the bedpost of the bed in the hotel room on top of Mount Equinox, and proceeded to transmit from there down to the state south of him, and gave a lot of people the state of Vermont. But his body was very close to that antenna, and in my opinion, that was of marginal safety, what he was doing. He was getting very close to the point of creating a human biohazard problem. Now, in the case of the bacteria that you put in front of the antenna, there's a couple of complications to that one, Frank, and that is the bacteria probably are in a petri dish, and they're in a medium of some kind that the bacteria like to eat and grow in. And so now, is the RF energy being absorbed by the media? It's getting hot, and that in turn is eating up the bacteria, or was the bacteria directly absorbing the RF energy, and they seeing the effects of RF energy independent of the heating of the medium that they're in? So doing a double-blind test and trying to find out what is really happening is a little bit complicated in that case. By the way, any kind of biological tests like this are very complicated. Not easy. There's a lot of ways of doing it wrong, but that's not bad. Even if you do an experiment and do it wrong and discover your errors and properly writing it up, that still makes it a good experiment. Remember when Thomas Edison was trying to find the right filament for a light bulb, and somebody, I think it was a newspaper reporter, interviewed him and said, hey, Mr. Edison, how's it going? And Mr. Edison said, well, I don't have it yet. I've tried this, 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 and this, and I am making progress. I know 3,221 substances that do not work. And since then, we've called that the Edisonian approach. And eventually, he found the right kind of a filament, a carbonized piece of thread, and the rest is history. But he just kept trying everything he could find until he found something that worked. So a failed experiment, properly documented, is not a failure. There's ways you can make this into the rise of the phoenix, so to speak. Out of the ashes of terrible things happening, you can something good can happen out of it. So, in the process of us having these discussions, and I think we're going to have them for a couple of weeks in a row, Elias, you will eventually refine your experiment. You'll find out how many watts you need, how available are those transmitters to you. Should you be taking the power out from the transmitter and putting it into an antenna? Should you be putting it into something that looks like a microwave oven? Should you be putting it into a pair of capacitive plates so that you're doing a diathermy experiment? There's a lot of different ways of doing it. Right now, I don't know if any of us here know the ideal way to do it. All we can do is tell you a little bit about our experience, give you some indication of what we think will work, what we think will not work. And so we invite you to come back week after week, ask more questions. I think you said you've got 6 questions, and I've heard the first one. I'm a little bit afraid to find out what the next 5 are going to be. You've given us quite a bit of trouble with the first one, Elias. KC2, QBX, KQIW in the TechNet.
I sort of just melded all 6 of them, but what I wanted to know is, do you know anyone who I could borrow this stuff from? And another question that I had was with the open space absorber, the free space absorber, how do we know what, how do we make sure that most of the energy is being absorbed, like in a microwave? So, KC2QBX.
Yeah, who has the equipment that you need? I mean, I think you'd like to do the experiment at 30 megs, 150 megs, 430 megs, 1,000 megs. at 10 gigs. I mean, these are all ham bands, and various people from time to time have that kind of equipment available to them, and are they willing to loan it to you? There's a bunch of questions there. So, by way of your ham radio friends, and here's a club of 300 and some odd members, there's a lot of people here, and hopefully some of those people have some of the equipment you're looking for and are capable of loaning it to you. So, in that respect, you may not have to buy everything. I didn't say it's easy, but at least you know there's a possible path there. It's a little bit difficult. It's going to take some research, testing, and experimenting to find out how you make sure that you know what percentage of the power output is going into the sample. If, for instance, I take my handy talkie, which maybe runs 3 watts of output, I put it into an amplifier, which has 30 watts of output, and I want to apply the 30 watts to the sample. And if I did it as a 2 capacitor plates as a diathermy experiment, you'd like to know what percentage of the power that I apply of the 30 watts is being absorbed by the sample, and what percentage is reflecting back to the transmitter. By way of a directional coupler, or by way of a Bird directional wattmeter, a Bird Model 43, you can measure in the transmission line between the transmitter, and I'm going to call it your sample box. You can measure how many watts are going forward. Maybe in my experiment, in my example, it would be 30 watts. And by flipping the slug on the Bird Model 3 directional wattmeter, you'll find out how much is reflecting back. And maybe the answer is 10 watts is reflecting back. So then by the laws of conservation of energy, if your Bird wattmeter tells you by making this measurement in the transmission line between the transmitter and the sample box, you find out that 30 watts is going forward, 10 watts is coming back. Unless there's some unknown loss mechanism somewhere in the transmission line and the box other than the sample, as long as you've got control of those things, you can be reasonably assured that 20 watts, the difference, was absorbed by the sample. And then you put 20 watts into the sample for some length of time and measure what is the temperature rise. Knowing the specific heat of the sample, knowing the quantity of the sample you've got there, how many grams of it, so to speak, and how many seconds you put in, how many watts, which each watt for 1 second is 1 joule of energy. So by way of some calculations and measurements, you'll know how many joules of energy you put into the sample, you know how many grams of sample you've got. In theory, you go to the right website or lookup table, you know what is the specific heat of the sample, and therefore the temperature rise you measure versus the temperature rise that you calculate, you can compare them to, and if they come close, you say, I've got a good experiment. If you calculated that you should have got 10 degrees centigrade rise, and you really got 1 degree centigrade rise, you and I would call that an experimental error, and then, as bad as that sounds, you should then do a whole bunch of investigation to find out where is the error coming from. Did you accurately measure the power going forward and the power coming back? Was the power being radiated into space and leaking out of the box? See, you can see where you can go with it. Even if you get what you think is a bad measurement, just like Thomas Edison, you can turn it into good news for the newspaper because you're learning what doesn't work, so to speak. Now, when it comes to microwave absorbers, like the absorbers they put on the wall of an anechoic chamber, an antenna testing chamber, if you go to the Emerson Cumming Company, they're one of the biggest manufacturers of microwave absorber materials that are used on the walls of anechoic chamber. The Emerson Cumming Company, I think I've forgotten where they're located. I used to know. Anyhow, you go to their website, you'll find out that they make about 1,000 different kinds of plastic and foam and rubber, all kinds of absorbers and epoxy glues and whatever. They make a lot of different kinds of chemistry. So each one of the products that they sell as an absorber has a rated frequency range over which it works well. So by their lookup table, that's one way to tell. Another way to tell is that if you have an antenna that you aim into free space and the signal is properly adjusted to have a very low standing wave ratio, that means of all the power you put into the antenna by way of its feed line, essentially all of it gets radiated into space. That's what a low standing wave ratio is intended to tell you. If the antenna has a fairly low standing wave ratio and you aim it into free space, you know the antenna is well adjusted. If you then put a big flat sheet of metal in front of the antenna and you aim the antenna into that sheet of metal, obviously the signal radiated by the antenna hits the sheet of metal, a lot of it reflects back and hits the antenna as an echo. As an echo, it will show up on your bird watt meter as reflective power. It'll show up on your standing wave ratio meter as standing wave ratio. So you can confirm the fact that you're sending energy to the sheet of metal and it's reflecting back because you have a brand new standing wave ratio. Then you take your absorber material and put it on the sheet of metal. And if the absorber material was ideal, it would be absorbing all the energy, none of it would reflect back, and you would again get the standing wave ratio measurement that you got when you aim the antenna into free space. So that's a radar cross-section measurement. That's a rudimentary way of making what's called RCS, radar cross-section. How big a sheet of metal gives you how much echo. It was in the early days of radar, that was called radar cross-section. That was the way they measured how big an echo you get off of each kind of airplane at each frequency, at each angle that you observe the airplane. They did an experiment somewhat like that by measuring the echo power with an antenna aimed at the substance or device in question. Maybe that helps. KC2, QBX, K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thanks. I think you really answered my question, but I'm working with this with a friend on this, so I'm actually just getting into ham radio, but I really think it would help if we could meet at any time. Could you just tell me when would be possible, if possible at all? Thanks, KC2QBX.
Yeah, that's not easy. Right now, I am a consulting engineer, Elias. I work every single day for my main client. I have two other clients that are demanding my services. So I don't have a lot of free time. So I'm not saying I can't. I'm just saying it's not going to be easy. When it comes to asking questions on the TechNet, see, I have set aside a few hours every Sunday night for the last 24 years. Let's see, I started in 1982. Yeah, 24 years. For 24 and a fraction years, I have set aside a certain number of hours Sunday night in which I get on the TechNet and me and my friends discuss ham radio-like subjects or electronics subjects that are of interest to ham radio operators. So I can volunteer the fact that you're allowed to come back as many weeks as you want, ask your questions with this particular group of people, and we will do the best we can to answer them. You probably can also call me on the telephone. You're about to ask when. I'll have to figure that one out as to when I have some free time. Most likely on weekends. My Monday through Fridays are booked solid, either trying to keep my consulting clients happy, or trying to keep my family happy, or trying to keep my cat happy, trying to keep my car running, and trying to keep all the appliances in my house running, and do some sleeping. During the week, I'm kind of booked. During weekends, I have a little more free time. So we should start off with a set of telephone conversations at first. When it comes to where do you go and who do you borrow the equipment from, that's going to take some research. I don't have a good answer for you on that one. If you needed a single transmitter on 2 meters, there's at least 5 guys on this frequency who will volunteer that immediately. But you're trying to do an experiment on multiple frequencies of similar amounts of power, and you want quite a few pieces of test equipment, and it would be nice to have them all at once. That's going to be a little more difficult. So, I'm not trying to discourage you. I'm just trying to tell you where we're coming from, where we're at, and what the degree of difficulty is here. I don't know what else to say. Of the people who have been listening to me and Elias tonight, anyone want to volunteer information, equipment, or whatever, please give us your call letters right now. KQLIW and the TechNet. Hope we didn't put them all to sleep. So, the best I can recommend, by the way, what is your deadline, Elias? In other words, you probably have to submit some form of a proposal defining the experiment. And my guess is you've got a certain length of time in which you've got to perform most of the experiment, start writing the report, in order for this to be done within the semester. Give me a little bit of a hint as to what your deadlines are like. And if you happen to know, tell me one or two other experiments that you know your fellow classmates are doing. When you talk to them, what kind of experiments are they doing? You've chosen a reasonably difficult experiment, but a darn good one. I mean, it's got all kinds of implications of radio frequency biohazard measurements. I mean, you're making a set of measurements that come very close to that. And that's a very interesting subject at this point in time. There are multiple communities on Long Island right now where the Department of Homeland Security is offering tens of millions of dollars to install radio antennas and transmitting and receiving equipment on top of water towers and radio towers and whatever in these various communities in order to improve the communication, the emergency communications for fire, police, and whatever, the ambulance, first responders. So in other words, the Department of Homeland Security is offering the hardware, offering the labor, and offering the equipment to be installed in these various communities. And quite a number of the communities are saying, no, the radio frequency biohazard, I don't understand it, it sounds dangerous, I don't want you putting that equipment in my community, don't do that in my backyard. I'm almost positive that these communities are absolutely wrong saying that, but because they don't understand RF radiation, that nasty word, I call it radio transmission, because they don't understand those words and they have an emotional response to it, they're saying no, no, no. And the Department of Homeland Security is saying, hey, we've got to do this to protect ourselves from terrorists, and you guys are not letting us do it. And it's not a matter of dollars. We're offering the hardware free of charge, and you're turning us down. That's crazy. So the subject you're into right now, radio frequency biohazard, is a very good subject. I wish the public had a lot more understanding and didn't have such a strong emotional response to the subject. So what you're doing is a very good one, but it's not easy. Do tell me one or two of the other experiments that some of your fellow classmates are doing so I can see what kind of decisions they're making. Back to you, Elias. KC2QBX, K2RIW and the TechNet.
K2KY, give me some ideas.
Okay, Mel, we're going to go to you right after Elias. Elias first, go ahead.
My deadline? I have about 2 months to do the experiment because none of my friends are doing an experiment like this. They're doing experiments all over, but none of them having to do with this kind of stuff. I already put in an outline for the experiment, but luckily none of my family or the teacher really knows much about this. So I can change it and it'll sort of be the same. But about what other people are doing, it's all over, nothing to do with this. Back to you.
Give me one example. Are some of your fellow students doing an experiment in chemistry, biology, mathematics? And by the way, I presume this is a science class that you're doing this for. Is that true, Elias?
Yes, it is. One of my friends is actually doing what things in nature affect turtles' emotions. But that's just out of the blue that I can remember. Yeah.
Okay. Mel, I bet you you've got some good hardware. Bet you've got some good suggestions. K2KEY, you got the floor. K2RIW in the segment.
Okay, good evening, everyone. And this is K2KEY. Well, Elias, I want you to get a hold of the ARRL handbook. I'm looking at 2004, the Comprehensive RF Engineering Reference handbook. That's the Amateur Radio Handbook, better known as. And in chapter number 9, they give you some very good hints on to what you want to do. There's some charts and all of the number of things showing you different frequencies and the effects of different frequencies. In fact, somebody had mentioned that the adult head here, in fact, which I never realized, that the adult head has a resonance of 400 megahertz, while the baby's head has a resonance of around 700 megahertz. So they give you a lot of information like that. I was just thumbing through it. And they have also the anthermal effects of EMR. And, also on things like use of measurements of RF energy as it affects cardiac pacemakers and how to measure those fields. So there's a nice chart, in fact, there of RF protection guidelines of body exposure in humans. Number of nice charts like that show you the different effects from 3 kilohertz to 300 gigahertz. So this would give you a lot of background. In fact, they'll give you even a few, show you how they determined this, what kind of experiments they did. And this may help you in some way just to get the theory of what you want to do, Elias, over.
Yeah, he's given me a great idea. Well, I just suddenly realized that because radio frequency biohazard is so poorly understood by 98% of the general American public, they think it's something that's really terrible. They've got all kinds of xenophobia, in other words, fear of the unknown, because the general public has so darn much fear in this subject. Even if you don't succeed in gathering the test equipment, you've got at least another approach going on here, Elias, and that is just doing a paper study, just finding out what worldwide web internet sources of information you could be using, just by looking at things like the Radio Amateurs Handbook, studying the American National Standard Institute C95 specification. Just by studying those things and writing a report on it, that in itself would be an extremely good science experiment. You don't really have to have real hardware and make real measurements. So if at worst you don't gather the hardware soon enough and don't get a chance to make the measurements soon enough, don't let that be discouraging. Just doing research, a paper research on the subject, so that you and the guy who reads your report understands the term, understands the technology, understands the dangers, gets rid of the xenophobia, in other words, the fear of the unknown, and just becomes familiar with the term. That in itself would be an extremely good scientific experiment, in my opinion, because this is a very hot subject, pun intended, right now. You'd be amazed how many Nassau communities right now are saying, not in my backyard, you're not going to install that homeland security equipment, even though it's going to protect me, even though it's going to keep me alive. I want you to put it somewhere else. I want you to put it in the adjacent town. There are multiple communities in Nassau saying those exact words in their zoning hearings, in their town hearings right now. As a person who's familiar with radio, I listen to these horror stories. To me, they're horror stories. These are strong levels of misunderstanding of what's going on and what you should be afraid of. And I'm amazed that some of these affluent, intelligent communities haven't assigned a group of people to research these subjects, to look into it, and find out where the smoke is and what's really going on, as opposed to just saying, I'm afraid of it, no, you're not going to do it. I mean, it's very nice to sit back and say, gee, why can't I have a nice, simple life like the good old days? Why does everything have to change? Well, if a person really has that opinion, you have the freedom in this country to go live with the Amish and the Mennonites in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You have the option of going there and living a very simple life if you want to. But if you have that extreme opinion, you shouldn't be forcing your opinion on your fellow citizens of your town, and such that you're denying the Homeland Security Department the ability to make the communication improvements that are definitely required. You dig deep enough and you'll find out that many police communication systems, many fire department communication systems, many ambulance communication systems are not adequate in many of those towns. Many of those towns have 15 and 20% dropout zones, where in those zones you cannot do a law enforcement operation because you are out of communication with your headquarters. No intelligent policeman will go into a dead zone and try to do a law enforcement operation. If he doesn't have that radio backup back to his headquarters where he can get help when he needs it, he would have to feel awful uncomfortable. The best example I can give of this is that after Hurricane Katrina, many of the police officers in New Orleans abandoned their post vacated the town because the radio equipment completely failed, and they felt their life was at risk. They weren't willing to take that much risk. They were thinking about their families, and they just got out of town. So law enforcement broke down terribly because the radio equipment was inadequate. So to getting the bottom line of all this, Elias, even if you don't get a chance to gather the equipment and make the measurements, if you just do the research to understand the terms, know how these measurements are made, find out what level of radio transmitter, of how many watts, for what period of time, how many feet away from a human being is and is not safe. Just a report on that subject would be an extremely good research project, even without touching hardware. I know, Elias, you're a ham radio operator. Ham radio operators are hands-on people. They like touching hardware. They want to see the real stuff work. And I know that's what you want to do. And with the constraints you've got of time, money, people, hardware, and whatever, there's some chance you may not be able to pull it all together in time. Don't give up, but even just a good report on the subject is a darn good science experiment, in my opinion. And I'll bet you your science teacher might agree with that. KC2QBX, consider that. K2RIW in the SecNet.